Yes.
It was almost really close.
All rise. The Court of Appeals of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Judge Bonnie Bullock presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bullock of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me today on the bench are my colleagues, Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. We are delighted to be here at Boyd Law School for oral arguments. We hope it will be interesting and educational for all of you. After arguments in both cases have been completed, we will entertain questions, just not about the cases argued before us, and we encourage counsel for the parties to participate, of course, not about your case. The students and faculty might like to know how you became interested in the law, who encouraged you to attend law school, and what area or areas of the law did you finally choose to practice in and why. Before we begin, the judges will tell you a little bit about ourselves and introduce our staff. I will also introduce members of our team who are here today and provide us with invaluable support. I graduated from ASU with a Bachelor of Science in Economics in 1984 and a law degree in 1987, and I became licensed in Nevada in October of 1987. I spent the first 19 years in private practice, primarily handling professional negligence cases, 12 years as the Discovery Commissioner for the 8th Judicial District Court, resolving a wide range of pretrial discovery disputes, and next month I will have been on the Court of Appeals for 7 years. I would like to now introduce you to our hardworking and dedicated staff. Shannon Westfall, who called us to order, is the clerk of our court. She is an attorney and a Boyd grad who assists us with our conferences, reviews, and prepares summaries in our emergency writs, and makes sure oral arguments run smoothly, and she is editor extraordinaire. Kurt Jensen, Kurt, raise your hand, who was our court clerk and is now the director of our central staff, is responsible for overseeing criminal and civil staff attorneys, managing staff assignments of the appeals transferred to staff for handling. Kurt is not a Boyd grad, I believe it's Washington University in St. Louis, and he is also an editor extraordinaire. We also have staff supervising attorney assigned to assist chambers with appeals, Patrick Kelly. I believe Kelly went to Berkeley. And we have Marshall Hedrick with us, who is our chamber's administrative assistant, who assists us with uploading our documents and helps keep us organized. A shout out to our IT here today, who ensure that these proceedings are recorded and available to the public. Special thanks to our security team today, Lieutenant Don Collins and Marshal Vincent Dinglassen. We appreciate you both so much. Unfortunately, my law clerk cannot be here today as he is taking the Washington Bar exam, but I am so glad to see all of you here. It means a lot to the Court of Appeals that you've taken the time out of your schedule to observe these proceedings, and we look forward to both arguments before us today. Judge Gibbons?
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Council, agreeing to have oral arguments here at the law school. I can recall having them in off locations, and it presents a unique challenge. So this is also a rare opportunity for you to do this here. I'm sure you'll always remember it. And I have some words of wisdom for the students after we're all done with the arguments today. I became a member of the Nevada Bar in 1980. I went to UCLA undergraduate, University of Idaho Law School in Moscow, Idaho. And when I was admitted to the bar, there was the unusual circumstance that you had to be a resident of the state of Nevada to even take the bar exam. That was presented a challenge in and of itself because my first case was challenging that rule. However, the judge that I had a job with, Howard McKibben, happened to be on the Board of Bar Examiners. Now, of course, he wasn't involved in it, but after I presented all of my evidence administratively, I was allowed to take the bar that I really was a Nevada resident. So that was a unique situation to start things. I worked for Judge McKibben for a year. This was in northern Nevada in Minden. I went straight from there to the district attorney's office, which was the next room over. I was in the Douglas County District Attorney's office for 13 years. And the main point about that is that I was in court almost every day. And when you're in court all the time, what do you learn? The rules of evidence. The rules of evidence are critical if you're going to be a lawyer that does any type of litigation at all. So I suggest you all consider clerking for a court either as an extern or as a normal law clerk as part of your law school process. I was in the DA's office for 13 and a half years. My last year I was in the civil division, and I was elected to the district court bench and served on the district court for 20 years. That also was in Minden in northern Nevada. But I was thought I wanted to get as much experience as possible, so I volunteered to serve in other districts. So I served in 10 different counties in the state of Nevada at some point as a visiting judge and did jury trials in 4 different counties, including several jury trials here in Clark County. When the Court of Appeals was created in 2014 by a constitutional amendment that was passed by the voters, I applied for the position. There were 36 applicants. I was fortunate to be one of the 3 that was selected and was also named the inaugural chief judge of the court, and I served in that capacity for almost 8 years. So I'm very, very happy to be here today and be serving with Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla, who almost 7 years now, and Judge Deborah Westbrook, who's working on her 4th year on the Court of Appeals. And again, I hope all of you look at this as a memorable experience as somehow might motivate you to consider it, working for a court, volunteering for a court, getting involved in the trial system, and also appellate work. It's a different angle than trial work. And so think about that too.
All right. My name is Judge Deborah Westbrook. I've been on the court since January of 2023. I was elected to the bench after serving for 10 years as an appellate public defender, so I came with appellate experience. I love appeals. I'm an appellate nerd. This is basically my dream job. Before that, I practiced in labor and employment law at Littler Mendelson for 8 years and clerked for the D.C. Court of Appeals from 2003 to 2004. I graduated from the University of Washington School of Law, also University of Washington undergrad, and ended up coming here to Vegas in 2004, and this has been my home ever since. I'm really excited to have you guys all here to listen to real appellate arguments with some fabulous appellate attorneys here that will be presenting for you and showing you what it looks like. And hopefully you'll catch the appellate bug the way I did when I clerked for my judge in D.C. I have pretty much I'm the only one with my chamber's staff here today. All of them came. I have Angelica Anderson, who is my law clerk, and 2 externs, Emma Johnson and Vanessa Brady, who are both current Boyd students. And I believe Lalita Kumar may be here. Is she? Where? There she is. Okay, she's going to be externing for me this summer. And I may have room for one more extern, so I'm you know, looking for applications. So thank you guys all for being here. Look forward to the arguments.
Can I mention him? I forgot to mention my law clerk is Michael Reeves. He's based in Carson City in northern Nevada, so he can't be here today, but he is watching or listening or will listen. However, we're able to do this later. Everything is recorded when we do an oral argument, so he'll pick up on that later.
Thank you. We will call the first case, which is Hambleton versus HELP Las Vegas Housing Corp, which we will refer to as HELP. This is the date and time set for the argument in this case, case number A9391. At council table, I believe we have attorneys Jonathan Lawrence Hilton and Michael Kane on behalf of appellant. And I understand, Mr. Hilton, you will be arguing today. Is that correct?
That's correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
And we have Dan Polsenberg on behalf of respondents. And who else do we have with you today?
Clerk Max Cork on behalf of respondents.
Thank you. And Mr. Paulsenberg, are you going to be arguing?
If the court please.
Very good. Thank you. Each party is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Hilton, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
Very good. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jonathan Hilton for the injured veteran and the plaintiff below, Mr. Jonathan Hambleton. Your Honors, I'd like to start by describing for you today the type of campus that the HELP defendants undertook to create when they accepted federal grant money to create a supportive housing program for homeless veterans. Then I want to move to the campus that HELP actually created and how that foreseeably led to alcohol-infused violence. So when HELP accepted that federal grant money, and I'm going to quote to you from the Code of Federal Regulations, it's on pages 11 and 31 of our opening brief, HELP undertook to create a sober environment that is free from illicit drug use or from alcohol use that could threaten the health and or safety of the residents or staff, hinders the peaceful enjoyment of the premises, or jeopardizes completion of the grantee's project goals and objectives. Now I want to turn to the campus that HELP actually created. This is from page 392 of our appendix volume 4, and it was presented on our motion for reconsideration to the district court, and it was also presented in our expert report from Charles Berry below. What HELP did was that it put the supposedly sober Genesis-controlled dry campus right here, and that was supposed to be the controlled environment with no alcohol coming in or out, but then it also placed the Renaissance building, which HELP claimed it ran no differently from any other landlord, on the same campus. These are surrounded by a high fence enclosing the entire area, and there's only two small little gates that nominally separate Genesis from Renaissance, but they were left unlocked 70% of the time. Everyone in the Renaissance side of campus had access to alcohol, and the HELP program even encouraged Renaissance residents like Mr. Franklin Ritchie to come to the Genesis side of campus to benefit from the federally funded free food. When you have a mixing of a supposedly dry campus in this way with a campus where there's unlimited access to alcohol, that is going to foreseeably create alcohol-infused violence, which is what my client suffered in this case.
Mr. Hilton, in opposition to HELP's motion for summary judgment, Hambleton took the position that the harm caused by Ritchie was foreseeable because HELP gave its residents welcome packages that had large knives and failed to enforce its own weapons policy that prohibited knives over a certain length. Then on reconsideration, he changed his theory of liability to argue what you are now saying, that because HELP failed to keep tenants at the dry campus Genesis away from the mentally ill tenants who drank at Renaissance, the act was foreseeable. Under Arnold v. Kipp, to what extent should this court consider the new theories of liability that were first raised on reconsideration, particularly when the district court's order did not expressly discuss them when it denied reconsideration?
When the district court denied the motion for reconsideration, in the transcript of the hearing, the court was explicit, and this is also in the order that was prepared and signed below, it was explicit that it was not a procedural denial. Of course, the district court had discretion not to entertain it, but the district court said this was a close call. It heard full argumentation on the merits. And so under Cohen, all of these theories come in.
Well, I guess the question I have is it mandatory for us to consider them on appeal, or is it merely permissive? Because I think Arnold versus Kipp says the court may consider if the two factors are met. If the, you know, information was in the court record prior to the appeal, such that it's part of the record and the court considered on the merits. I think the case uses the word may. So are we required to consider these arguments on appeal?
Even if it's permissive, Your Honor, you should certainly do so because it was fully presented to the district court. And the theory of liability overall is the totality of the circumstances test. We certainly argued totality of the circumstances along with the same kind of incidents in our original motion, in our original opposition. We argued about how Ritchie in particular was dangerous. We argued about Mr. Ritchie's history.
Well, Mr. Hilton, let me interrupt you for a moment. This case was granted summary judgment on the issue of duty. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So is there any dispute that Ritchie's act of stabbing Mr. Hamilton constituted an intentional tort?
Yes, Your Honor, and here's why. So in terms of whether it was an intentional tort or a superseding cause on Mr. Ritchie's part, he was suffering from delusions. He was suffering, and this is the exact kind of risk that the help defendants created.
But the act of stabbing someone, in this case, unfortunately, Mr. Hamilton, was an intentional act. You're not arguing that it was somehow negligent.
He was subject to delusions at the time. So was it intentional in the sense that Mr. Ritchie intended to grab the knife and commit the act of stabbing? Yes.
And that happened in Mr. Ritchie's private apartment, correct?
That's correct, but it's not dispositive, and here's why. Under the Turple case, the Supreme Court of Nevada held that issues of public or common use are no longer dispositive. And you see proof of that in the Dowd case, for instance, which takes place entirely within a motorhome. You see proof of that in Rockwell, where it's a shooting that takes place in a private apartment. You see that as well in O'Hara, which we cite in our reply brief. So while that's true, it is not dispositive.
Are you asking this court to extend the duty of keeping premises safe for residents to include a private residence, a private apartment in this type of a complex? Is that essentially what you're asking this court to do?
I don't believe that there's any actual extension of duty here because the duty to separate these two campuses was already imposed by the Code of Federal Regulations. Because it's one campus, they've already violated a duty. And under the Shalaba case, what help was required to do was not take actions that increased the risk of harm. So here in this case, not only did they enclose these two campuses together, but they actively encouraged Mr. Ritchie to come over into the supposedly controlled side of campus. So it's not a passive landlord negligence case. It's one where help has taken that extra step. It's undertaken very specific duties, and it is increasing the risk that this kind of thing will happen. So in a normal landlord-tenant situation or even a normal homeless shelter, you're not going to necessarily get to that added duty. But here, with those additional acts that foster the entire situation, that's when we go back to Shalaba. If you think about the Shalaba case, the only purported act of negligence in that case was that a contractor who was on site working with the landlord had left a door unlocked. That was the purported negligence, and the Supreme Court of Nevada held that that was sufficient to foreseeably increase the risk of criminal activity.
Isn't the harm that occurred in this case a little bit more attenuated than the harm that occurred when you failed to unlock a door in Scalaba, for instance? I mean, in that case, the act of unlocking or leaving that door unlocked allowed somebody to go into that room, that apartment, and then come out and immediately attack the resident who lived across the hall. Whereas in this case, it seems you're suggesting the failure to keep the two properties separate allowed the parties to become acquainted with one another. And then once they were acquainted in that private relationship between those two parties, there was an altercation.
Well, honestly, I believe this case is Shalaba on steroids. Because when you have a simple act of unlocking a door, okay, that could result in an intruder. But in this case, help is actually enclosing with a high fence both sides of the campus, and they're encouraging. If you think about from Mr. Hamilton's perspective, help has admitted that it was his custodian, that it had a duty to keep him safe while he's on the campus. But it has put him in a situation here where there's unlimited alcohol on one side of campus, but there's not really anything to do on the other.
Well, isn't he able to leave the premises and go get alcohol at a bar or at a grocery store if he wishes?
He can leave, Your Honor, but he is supposed to be safe while he is on the campus. So the duty that help undertook here was to keep him safe while he's on campus. And if you also think about the control that help exerted over him in his lease, he actually is forbidden from going off campus to drink. And that is something he could have been evicted for.
Since the district court assumed a special relationship existed between the parties in this case and essentially didn't address that issue, just assume for the sake of argument, would you agree that foreseeability is really the only legal issue that this court needs to address on appeal?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because under Sataquoi Bay, once you resolve this particular issue, you can always go for simply a remand to consider that issue. So I do believe the argument here is very narrow, and there's no need to address anything beyond foreseeability.
Mr. Hilton, where is the line between foreseeability of harm decided as a matter of law versus a jury question? How do you draw the line?
Well, I think that in terms of the foreseeability, you're going to look, one, at the degree of attenuation, but I think, second, you can look at something like the Bokelman case, which is an example of where the Nevada Supreme Court did choose to draw a line. In the Bokelman case, you had one adult who gave access to another adult a hunting rifle in the privacy of his own home. In that case, the Nevada Supreme Court held, in particular, because the recipient of the gun, the person who had access, because there was full evidence that he had been rehabilitated, he'd been reintegrated into the lives of society and both parties, and his only crime for which he'd been imprisoned was 13 years ago, that's a place where the Nevada Supreme Court drew the line. But here you have substantial evidence, not only about the situation in general, but also very specific to Mr. Ritchie.
You have about 2 minutes and 50 seconds left. Would you like to reserve the
rest I'll reserve.
Of your time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Pulsenberg?
Good morning, Chief Judge Bula, and may it please the court, Dan Pulsenberg for the help entities. Duty is a question of law, and that's not by accident, and that's not by coincidence, because it just, Judge Gibbons, it really is a philosophical and jurisprudential issue where we don't let every case go to the jury. If there's any theme between the two cases you have for argument this morning, and I'm not suggesting that there is, it's the role of the court versus the role of the jury. And you know, ever since Chief Justice Roberts' confirmation hearing, judges like to say, we just call balls and strikes. But, you know, Major League Baseball has a 124-page rule book. There is a strike zone. There are foul lines. The court doesn't just let every case go to the jury, or we would be a nation of jurors and not laws. I don't usually start by talking about the facts. In fact, Justice Douglas used to keep me from talking about the facts. But I need to, in this circumstance, briefly address what we're calling the campus here. This is the Genesis on the lower end, the eastern end. This is the Genesis facility. And Judge Delaney said you have to treat the facilities differently. And yes, there is a high wall around them. There are two gates in the wall, and congratulations to counsel for catching that there are two gates, although the briefs say there's one. And it's a separate facility on Renaissance. Now let's remember what all of this does in Genesis. It's not to keep the residents in. They're free to leave. You're right, Judge Westbrook. They're free to leave. In fact, Mr. Hambleton, the night of the stabbing, went out the front door instead of the back gates, went out the front door to Main Street. I don't know if you've ever been in Main Street in that neighborhood. And made a left and went to Jerry's Nugget Casino and drank. We are not there policing their lives and locking them in. This is not, some people have characterized it in the briefing as a alcohol rehabilitation center. I'm speaking at Desert Hope in 2 days. This is not inpatient drug rehab. This is transitional living for homeless veterans. And yeah, do we prohibit alcohol on the premises? Yes.
Well, Mr. Paulsenberg, just to be clear, HELP owns both properties
and
residences, both Genesis and Renaissance, right?
Yes, I don't dispute that.
Right. So
different, and realize there are different entities involved. They have characterized us as monolithic. That's not the point of this motion for summary judgment.
But HELP today, as we've characterized you as the label HELP, we understand that there are different entities.
Fair enough.
But the properties are essentially owned by the entities or related entities that are here before us
enough
today.
For our purposes, yes.
Okay. So if Hamilton's stabbing had occurred on the property, not in the private apartment of Mr. Ritchie, would HELP have owed a duty to Hamilton?
The analysis would be different, I think, in that circumstance. And I think we'd be looking more like the casino cases. We would have to look at, counsel said that you look at the totality of the circumstances. There are times when the Nevada Supreme Court does that, and there are times when they look at the individual. In Thomas versus Bokelman, in Mangaris, they looked at the individual to see whether there was a duty to warn.
Do you think it matters that this stabbing took place in a private apartment?
Yes.
Why?
First of all, in a private apartment, we didn't have any indication, just as a general security thing, that there is something that we had to do in a private area. And looking at the totality of the circumstances, the location is completely different. If it had happened in Mr. Hambleton's apartment in Genesis, I think we would have to look at all the different occurrences and see whether we had adequate security. The idea that we had a security case here, I'm going to borrow what Judge Westbrook said, it's so attenuated, it looks like their security case is that we didn't keep them from becoming acquainted. You know, I think it's like suing Lord Capulet for insufficient security to keep Romeo from crashing the party in Act 1, Scene 5, and then he wouldn't have met Romeo and they'd both be alive today. That is so far-fetched that it is not a case. Now, my friend Joe Regalia posted that plaintiff's opening brief in this appeal is very well written because it makes its point throughout the brief. Well, it might be a good rhetorical device. The problem I have is they don't have a point. They keep saying we have a duty, and they don't say a duty to do what. The law would be, we would be entitled to summary judgment if we didn't have a duty to do other than what we did. They're saying that we shouldn't have let Mr. Ritchie come in and have meals, or they might not have met, that we should not have let. There's no duty, and we do not say under the Code of Federal Regulations that we will keep Mr. Hambleton on the Genesis property. He left the property as he is free to do. He has to check in once a day. But he leaves the property. There's no restriction on alcohol in Renaissance. It is an ordinary low-income apartment building. And yes, Judge Westbrook, you are right. I do not have a knife. This is a sheath. Their original claim was simply that 10 years before, we may have given him a chef's knife, which they call now a butcher's knife, because all their factual representations are skewed beyond the record to try to create some doubt as to whether we did what we were supposed to do.
So I want to ask you a sort of related question to what I asked opposing counsel. Would you agree that Hambleton satisfied the two-part test from Arnold v. Kipp in this circumstance? And if so, are we required to consider the new theories of liability?
No, you don't. And I do not think that Judge Delaney considered their new theories.
She said she considered it on the merits. Do you think that statement in her order was sufficient to kind of give us guidance for how we should evaluate what she did?
No, because she was saying that she is sticking with her original ruling. So this new theory, I have a problem with this case. They changed their theory in reconsideration. They changed it in their opening brief. They changed it in their reply brief. It is so nebulous that I am saying, with respect, they don't have a point. They're not saying what the duty is. They're combining cases where some defendants may or may not have, usually not have, a duty regarding an individual with casino security cases, where there is enough. In Dowd versus Hilton, the Nevada Supreme Court said there was enough crime in the Hilton parking lot by the race and sports book that they should have had security there. In Early versus NLB, they talked about you needed to have security, not just where the money is, you needed to have it in the restrooms. There was all sorts of notice there, which is also why I think that it is a superseding intervening case.
So help characterized its summary judgment motion below as a discrete no duty motion. And I think the specific language was discrete no duty motion for summary judgment, which is focused on the dispositive issue of whether Franklin Ritchie's random stabbing of the plaintiff was reasonably foreseeable. Given the limited nature of the relief that was sought below, is it proper for us to be considering your arguments on appeal relating to superseding causation?
We did brief superseding. I know, Max.
Not in your motion for summary judgment below. Maybe in response, but if your motion is discrete, no duty, how do we on appeal start addressing other issues?
Okay, bad answer first, then good answer. So I think they're flip sides of the foreseeability question. If you look, it's really only Bowers that addressed it. Bowers that addressed superseding intervening cause. That's the biker gang fight, where all the other cases use the same analysis to talk about duty. I'm fine with just a duty case. I do think special relationship is still an issue in this case.
Even though the court assumed for all purposes that it was, there was a special relationship?
Yeah, you can't rule against me unless you say that there is a special relationship and foreseeability. The district judge said, I don't need to get the special relationship. The Nevada Supreme Court in Magaris said, we can assume there's a special relationship because there's no way that anybody would have a duty. That was the case where the massage parlor didn't, Nevada has such interesting fact patterns. The massage parlor didn't warn the taxi cab driver that the patron was a nefarious fellow and a fugitive. And the Nevada Supreme Court said, well, nobody would warn that. Nobody. It is so remote logically that you would not consider there to be a duty to make such a warning.
Mr. Pulsenberg,
Your Honor,
if we do find that there is a duty as a matter of law, you would agree that the summary judgment should be reversed and the case would have to be remanded for the trier of fact to determine if there was breach of duty, causation, and damages.
Yes.
And I believe that discovery has been completed below.
I would have to check with Max on that, but yes, you would. If you, the only issue here is the pure legal issue of duty, which is an important legal issue. And that's where the court serves its gatekeeping function. With respect, we don't give every case to juries.
Well, You said that, Mr. Polzenberger, of course, to start your argument, and no one would disagree with that. Not every case goes to the jury, but that's not the question. The question is, what is at the line? What is on the margin of it? And you turned your argument from that statement to, let's talk about the facts. So aren't the facts really controlling it? If there are enough facts to establish each of the elements of negligence, then it would go forward about the question on duty, proximate cause, foreseeability. It's not Paul's graph.
I have Paul's graph with me. So it, since we have a law school here, so when I talked about are the undisputed facts, because they're trying to create an impression that the situation here is different from what it is. We are not custodians in the non-regulation sense, where we have to, we are not an inpatient rehab center where we have to keep a drug addict in there to keep him away. It is not just drugs, but they point out on page 6 and 16 of their opening brief, he also has to abstain from sex. Now, what if he was at, in different facts, different hypothetical, if he was at the Renaissance building on a romantic liaison and something had happened? That would not create a duty on our part. We don't police the Renaissance rooms. If somebody had broken into the Genesis area and broken into one of the rooms, we would be looking at it like a hotel security case. Is there enough there that we had, remember one of the cases talked about the security at the casino, they were just glorified porters. Do we have enough security to keep people safe within that facility? That's not the facts we have here.
Mr. Polzenberg, did HELP have any policy to discourage residents of Genesis from interacting with the residents of Renaissance or from visiting residents in the Renaissance building?
No. As a matter of fact, those gates have crash bars. That was not to keep people in. We also didn't have a policy to discourage people from going to Jerry's Nugget Casino, which is where they went that night and drank. I have a minute left. I'd be doing my client a misservice if I didn't talk about my client. They talk about HELP as a monolithic, profit-driven entity. HELP USA is a 501c3, a nonprofit, a charity. We operate transitional housing. We operate low-income housing. These are people who have a particular mission. And I think the idea that the mission goes further or that this becomes just profit-driven is inappropriate. I also know these people, and so I can tell you that they care about Mr. Hamilton. This is not a situation where I'm just a lawyer saying he brought it on himself. All of us feel bad for Mr. Hamilton, but it was, Chief Judge Bula, an intentional act. They haven't argued lack of capacity under the Nevada Mallon case, and in fact, he was convicted of attempted murder. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Polzenberg. Mr. Helton.
Thank you, Your Honors. Well, you heard it time and time again. We don't police Renaissance. Renaissance is separate. Renaissance has different policies. But that really goes to the defective design of this campus. If what HELP undertook to do was to create a controlled environment that was going to be free from alcohol use, this is not how one would typically design the campus, with one portion of it, and it's a very small campus, so you just have one portion of it where you have a supposedly dry, controlled campus, but then right there you have that access to alcohol.
So I have a two-part question. What was the duty of care or duties that you contend helped owed to Mr. Hamilton in this case? And then second, what is the connection between those alleged duties and the harm that occurred?
First is duty to warn, Your Honor. That was pled in the complaint. Duty to warn, you will find it throughout my brief, both my opening brief and the reply brief, you'll find us talking about duty to warn, because HELP had superior knowledge of Mr. Ritchie.
So in the duty to warn cases, generally they have to have specific knowledge of very specific incidents involving the person. Would you agree? In the cases involving duty to warn.
Well, I actually think that there's a pretty big gap in the case law on duty to warn. So
I mean, isn't it somewhat different than just mere totality of the circumstances when you're talking about a duty to warn from about a person, a specific individual? Doesn't there have to be some background for that individual that gives rise to a duty to warn about that person? Because otherwise, if it's just a mentally ill person, are you going to go around and warn, we have a mentally ill person living in our residence, stay away from him, he might do something crazy. I mean, is that where the argument is, or does it have to be specific to the person?
I think that duty to warn can be any time that you create a hazard. And this is a hazard that's being created. Now, if you want to get into specifics on Mr. Ritchie, you do have, in 2018, he calls the police, threatens them, says, you better bring your guns. You have, in 2019, he almost catches help on fire because he claims to have burned $23,000 in his oven. You have him being banned from coming to the Genesis side for a week because he's too argumentative with staff. So there is a whole background.
So what were they supposed to say to Mr. Hambleton?
Well,
were they supposed to tell him, hey, we've got this guy, don't talk to him?
And in fact, that's what they did after the fact. Don, the security officer, goes to Mr. Hambleton afterwards, after the event has taken place, and says, you know, Mr. Ritchie, he told me that he threatened to kill his children, or that he had killed his children. So
do they have to announce that to every resident at Genesis, that they have somebody there that has made these threats? I mean, wouldn't that potentially open up some concerns for privacy for mentally ill folks at the Renaissance?
They're not a medical provider, so there's nothing that's going to be covered by HIPAA. This is actually based on what Mr. Ritchie had told, specifically to Don, the security officer, who then in turn told my client anyway, after the fact. So there isn't actually a confidentiality concern. They could do poster, they could do text blast, email blast, any of that. And they meet with Mr. Hambleton regularly.
So would there be a duty to do that for every person that was mentally ill at Renaissance, that maybe had some issues that they should have posted at Genesis? All of these people, beware of this individual, beware of that individual.
Level, but Mr. Ritchie was also known for coming over. And then I want to say the second duty besides duty to warn is the duty to create a sober campus under the Code of Federal Regulations. It's that duty to create a sober campus. They undertook that duty. If you're thinking Wright v. Shum, what did they undertake? They undertook to do it. They failed to do it. And that foreseeably led to alcohol-based violence. If you don't create a sober campus, you create a campus that encourages alcohol use instead. If you think about the level of generality you need under Shalaba for foreseeability, alcohol-infused violence meets that. So duty to warn, duty to create a sober campus. Thank you. I see my time has expired.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, all of you, for your excellent arguments and insights into the issues before us. We value your participation in today's arguments. This matter will remain under submission, and this court will issue a decision in the near future. And now we will take a brief recess just for counsel to change seats to our next, for counsel coming in on the next case. And I would very much like current counsel, if they are able to stay and discuss any questions that the students and faculty may have after the second oral argument is completed. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. I know that happened in the middle of it.
You have the sign? Is that me?
No, it's me.
Hey,
you're me.
I can't see the sign. It's funny, the very first oral argument we had, Dan also heard thought of a poster board like that. And it was like, why are we having the evidence here from the trial?
Is that on Pinter? Is that the Pinter?
Yeah.
I did all the discovery in that case. I was very surprised. that happened at trial.
No, not at all. I think it was interesting. I had a bunch of other questions, so I just...
Yeah. I don't have as many for this one. What if I have time to... Well, probably don't have time to go to the bathroom.
If you need to go.
See. Oh, it's already 10:45, so...